Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, June 9th, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Tuesday. It is 64 degrees and raining here in upstate New York. It's been a couple pretty soggy days. And everything is just exploding in green. But hey, I can't complain because some of my poor friends down in the South are experiencing 96 degrees and it's only June. I would melt in temperatures like that and can't imagine what it would be in August. So yesterday, we took a look at a bunch of things. We titled the show, No One in Charge of Bioterror Pathogens and Incompetence. We discovered in reading a story, I think we were looking at the anthrax again, the DOD discovering that after all this time they hadn't been properly killing anthrax, yet they were shipping it all over the globe and potentially to all 50 states. And we found out that we only needed one grain of anthrax to be able to make a bioterror weapon. And so how great it is that the DOD is telling us that there's nothing to worry about yet. The story we read yesterday said, A, there's no organization in charge, solely in charge of bioterror pathogens. There is no one organization that's in charge of all these labs that are handling these bioterror pathogens. And nobody has any type of standards as far as being able to do a standard operating procedure for building. Hold on, I have that story back up here. I wanted to find that because it was just insane. There was no standard for building, constructing, designing, commissioning, or for operation of high containment laboratories. So, you know, my first thought was how they're moving Plum Island to Kansas, and they're building this new facility that'll be done. I don't even remember if it was this year, 2015, or next year, 2016. But how frightening is that, that there are no standards at all? So as an update to that, I only found one little blurb. Of course, they said that the number is going to increase. The blurb from this morning was from CBS News. The government's anthrax investigation is now broadened to include up to 66 labs and 19 states. So that is up now from the original 51 labs and 17 states. In addition to the District of Columbia, Pennsylvania is the newest state added to the list, and there have been no changes to the numbers of workers taking medication. So, phew, that makes me feel good. Pretty much the rest of the story continued with everything that we read about yesterday. One of the other things I wanted to hit on today, we had talked about this a few days ago, but there's more. Oh, wait, there's always more, is the TSA and how the TSA has managed to blow their $8 billion budget with 95% failure rate when they were tested to see. Oh, and just as I tried to connect myself, Skype gave me a flash. Hold on. Here we go. When they were tested to see how many holes they had in their security. So let's play this video because then I have an update to this.
With planes, trains, subways, highways, and more under their watch, the TSA has 62,000 employees and an annual budget pushing $8 billion. But the scathing new report of a 95% failure rate in detecting airport threats backs what independent studies have said for years. Taxpayers aren't getting much for their money. Exhibit 1. In 2010, when backscatter scanners were deployed, they were immediately assailed as ineffective, possibly dangerous, and needlessly intrusive, virtually strip-searching passengers.
And we knew all about that. Wasn't that, I don't even remember what the hell his name was, but it was the guy who had been in charge of either FEMA or Homeland Security who actually owned all those scanners, the naked scanners that they were swapping our pictures around with between all the TSA agents.
Despite spending more than $130 million, within 2 years, the TSA was pulling them out of major airports. Exhibit 2, a congressional report found the TSA warehousing thousands of pieces of equipment it overbought or does not need, and wasting as much as $100 million on poorly planned shipping.
Surprise! Is that like the $10 million toilet seat issue?
Such things make members of Congress like Florida Republican John Micah howl.
It's out of control.
And Exhibit 3, the TSA has spent around $1 billion on a program to spot potential terrorists by their behavior, despite a Government Accountability Office assessment that says it is virtually worthless.
And we talked about that a few days ago, the fact that they're scanning everybody at an airport for, you know, any type of strange behaviors, looking at your watch, sweating, looking irritated. I mean, come on, who doesn't feel like that at the airport? And personally, I get nervous every time I go there because I always then envision the plane crashing before I get on.
The TSA for over a decade now has been a horribly bureaucratic agency. They don't seem to learn from their past mistakes. They've spent billions of dollars on things that don't work.
There have been.
And the thing is, our government doesn't seem to listen to us because we said this in the very beginning. This was another level of security that didn't need to be there. I mean, I don't have any issue with any type of real threats, but just like taking everybody's phone calls because everyone might be a potential terrorist, scanning every single person, every child, making, I mean, I've seen some really horrifying videos of them making children like pull up their shirts and groping their crotches. How fucking disgusting is that?
And embarrassments too, like videos of airport workers, including TSA employees, stealing from passengers' bags.
Yes, we've seen that too.
It was supposed to be different. In the wake of 9/11, the newly established TSA was held up as a model of efficiency and safety.
You already know you're not a threat. Show us by packing smart.
And the agency has undeniably stopped some threats. So despite all the bad news at the White House,
the president does continue to have confidence that...
Of course he does.
The officers of the TSA do very important work that continue to protect the American people and continue to protect the American aviation system.
Tom Foreman, CNN, Washington.
I mean, what a crock that is. So, of course, yes, it keeps us safe. And just like the DOD and the CDC keep us safe by shipping anthrax all over the planet, the TSA keeps us safe, too, with their 95% failure rate when they've done testing, sneaking guns and other incendiary devices through their security. But wait, it gets even better. Here was a video that I caught this morning that Pigmine uploaded last night. Check this out.
A Senate Committee on Homeland Security will meet today to discuss disturbing gaps in airport screenings. It follows the release of a report showing the TSA failed to prevent dozens of airport workers with ties to terrorism from receiving access to secured areas of U.S. airports. Chris,
what? What did she just say? Yes, she did. Dozens of TSA workers who were on the terror watch list from having access to certain locations at airports. Wait, I'm going to back this up because I just could not believe this.
The release of a report showing the TSA failed to prevent dozens of airport workers with ties to terrorism from...
What? Airport workers with ties to terrorism? Gee, that should make you feel really safe getting on a plane.
Receiving access to secured areas of U.S. airports. Chris Van Cleve is at Reagan National Airport with the reason behind the lapse. Chris, good morning.
Yes, let's hear more excuses. That's, you know, I got to tell you, that's one thing when I was raised, my dad had a thing about excuses and people who claimed lack of personal responsibility. There weren't any excuses. No matter, I was like the queen of excuses. And his response to me would be, Jewel, no excuses. Get it done. Do it the right way. No excuses. And our government just seems to be a bag full of fucking excuses.
Good morning. The TSA screens travelers at checkpoints like this one across the country. It also screens aviation workers, checking them against the terror watch list every time it's updated. But now we're learning the TSA isn't seeing the whole picture. According to a new Inspector General report, the TSA does not have access to the entire watch list, including...
Wait a minute. If the TSA doesn't have access to the entire watch list and they're supposed to be scanning oncoming passengers... for potentially being on the terror watch list and being terrorists. How does that work? So now they're saying that the reason why all these employees that were connected to terrorists that have been working at airports was because they didn't have access to the entire terror watch list.
Information that would have flagged 73 people believed to have ties to terrorist groups employed by airlines, airport vendors, and others with access to secure areas of airports in the U.S.
Now, how many of those individuals maybe had access to secure labs? That's a good question. You know, since we don't even know how many labs or how many potential terrorists. I mean, is this what I'm trying to figure out in my head now? Is are they trying to make a case for the fact that they voted down renewing, which, you know, it didn't help us anyway, renewing the surveillance on cell phones, let's say? Are they trying to say, well, look, we didn't have access to everything, and now that you want to get rid of access to everything and collecting all data, that's what caused our failures? I mean, is that what they're trying to do here? Or are they just showing us how absolutely incompetent every level of this quote-unquote security keep us safe is?
The report noted the agency's vetting was generally effective.
Oh, yes. Well, generally effective works for me.
But identified thousands of aviation worker records that appeared to be incomplete or inaccurate, including...
Oh, okay. Thousands of records incomplete or inaccurate.
75,000 immigrants that did not list a passport number and 87,000 files without a social security number.
Wait a minute. How do you get employed without a social security number? Any job that I have ever worked, that was something that you had to provide before you ever started day one. And we're talking about the Federal Aviation Administration and airports across the country, 87,000 workers without social security numbers.
Something by law the TSA cannot require.
The fact that TSA has incomplete information, that's problematic because terrorist groups will try to take advantage of that and will try to infiltrate via those vulnerabilities.
Of course, the big question is how dangerous are those 73 people? And the portion of the report that might tell us that was redacted. The TSA said in a statement it is aware of the vetting issues and working to correct them by the end of the year. Gail?
Thank you, Chris.
So by the end of the year. But yes, we redacted the report, so you have no idea who they are or where they are. But make sure you get on a plane, because don't worry about it. When this next big terror attack happens, we're not going to blame it on the TSA. I mean, I just can't get over how asinine this gets every single day. It gets even more asinine than the day before. All right, so from here, I don't know. What do we want to deal with today? How about some more surveillance? Here's a good one. This came out of fizz.org this morning. Car to driver, we are not moving with that blood alcohol. Yes, yes, the car is going to tell you whether or not now you are fit to drive. Inventing a world without drunk driving would make a life safer for everyone. And hey, I'm not advocating drunk driving at all. Anyone who gets into a car that is wasted especially and decides to drive, I think they have an issue. I mean, I've seen a lot of that in my lifetime with friends, family, acquaintances, and I don't agree with it whatsoever. But I also don't agree with my car deciding to tell me and make the decision for me that I am not capable. It says a path leading to better driver safety is underway. An alcohol detection system for driver safety comes by way of a research program. The Driver Alcohol Detection System for Safety, or DADSS for short, has been on a mission to advance alcohol detection technology in vehicles. You know, the thing is that it's not going to stop with alcohol detection, okay? We already know that there's behavior detection that doesn't seem to be working in airports. They also have this facial recognition that they're playing with in cars that's going to be able to detect whether or not you're having road rage at that moment. And when you have these self-driving cars, it'll be able to take over control of the vehicle from you if you are having a road rage moment to keep you, again, safe. All right, back to the story. It says they have been at work on a safety feature protecting against drunk driving, and their system is designed to measure the alcohol in a driver's blood in less than a second. If it is above 0.08, which is the legal limit in all 50 states, the car simply won't move. I wonder if it'll also dial the cops to come pick you up. For drivers under 21, for whom any amount of alcohol is illegal, the system can be programmed for a zero tolerance policy. And yes, that is what they're teaching our children in many different venues. Zero tolerance seems to be what they want the kids to learn for the future. I mean, I don't know. We've seen so many stories. That one little boy is the one that I remember that kissed the little girl's hand. And it was a video from last year or the year before, I believe. It went viral. And he was suspended for sexual harassment at like 5 because of a zero tolerance policy. I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous. But again, for under 21, I do agree. You know, 16-year-old does not have a command of their vehicle. You know, I've been driving for 30 plus years now. And, you know, when you've been driving that many years, and especially when you've been driving the same car for a lot of years, my car is now 10, 11 years old. You know, that thing becomes a part of your body. You're pretty good at it. You know, all the moves, the secret moves to keep you safe. But at 16, you're not going to know. But still, again, the fact that we now have a device that's going to be dictating to us and quote unquote keeping us safe is the bothersome part about this, regardless of what it's for. So to get an accurate and reliable reading, the creators are exploring two technologies, a breath-based system or a touch-based system. And we do know that there's already technologies out there that can tell if you've had any type of illegal substances just by measuring your fingertip sweat. Or using lasers to scan your lips, it'll be able to tell what you have for breakfast. Earlier this month, reports in the Detroit News, the Highway Traffic Safety Administration unveiled the first ever prototype vehicle carrying the advanced alcohol detection technology. How it works, the breath-based system pulls a driver's breath into a sensor. The sensor could be placed in the driver's side door or in the steering column as the driver breathes normally. And a beam of infrared light is directed at the breath's molecules. Carbon dioxide and alcohol molecules absorb different amounts of light, and the sensor compares the two. Alcohol levels can be measured precisely, even in small concentrations. And if the proportion of alcohol molecules to carbon dioxide molecules is over a certain range, it indicates an illegal blood alcohol level. The system captures only the driver's breath. And that was the question I was going to ask. What if you were the designated driver and you had some very inebriated person sitting in the passenger seat who obviously smells stinkingly like alcohol? We've all been there at one point or another in our lives. What is going to prevent that alcohol from mixing with my breath and just shutting off my car? The touch-based technology reads alcohol below the skin surface. I would think that that would be a much more accurate measurement. Sensors in the car's ignition button or in the gear shift shine a beam of light onto a finger. That's just very similar to the airport one we talked about last week. Alcohol absorbs specific wavelengths of light, and by measuring the light's intensity, the system can pinpoint the blood alcohol level. When this detection system is ready for commercialization, according to a promotional video, people will be able to buy the alcohol detection system as a safety option, just like the emergency brake assist or the lane departure warning. Now, again, how long do you think it's going to be, just like black boxes, to keep you safe before they put that standard into cars? I actually think this might be a video for this. So let's see. Maybe this is the promo video. It appears to be so.
Our cars are getting smarter, and now a new safety feature is being developed to protect against drunk driving. The alcohol detection system will measure the alcohol in a driver's blood in less than a second. If it is above 0.08, the legal limit in all 50 states, the vehicle won't move. For drivers under 21, for whom any amount of blood alcohol is illegal, the system can be programmed for a zero-tolerance policy. To get an accurate, reliable reading, two technologies are being explored, a breath-based system and a touch-based system. The breath-based technology pulls the driver's exhaled breath into a sensor, which could be located in the driver's side door or in the steering column as the driver breathes normally.
So it appears that this is just a regurgitation of everything that I just read. The one thing that I see where this might be helpful would be if you purchased your teenager a car, which I wouldn't recommend that for anyone. I mean, if you're a teenager, get yourself a job, save up a couple $1,000 and buy yourself a clunker, right? I get so irritated when I see these little snot noses that have BMWs that rich mommy and daddy bought for them, so they never know what it's like to work a day in their lives and to earn something. All right, a little bit at the very bottom here. The NHTSA Administrator Mark Rosenkind said in the Detroit News that, quote, making it an option available to vehicle owners would provide a powerful new tool in the battle against drunk driving deaths. Who is involved in the DADS program? Groups include the National Highway Safety. Hold on one second. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, the Automotive Coalition for Traffic Safety as well, and the latter represents automakers' research and testing. It is overseen by independent engineers and scientists. The DADS said that the program is also supported by, quote, members of the alcohol industry, including the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States, the National Beer Wholesalers Association, and the Wine and Spirits Wholesalers of America. Obviously, a system of this nature requires accuracy, precision, and reliability. Research continues, and prototypes will be integrated into vehicles for field tests. Engineers will be able to observe driver behavior in natural settings, and real-world scenarios will be used. And according to the Detroit News, Rosenkind said that he hoped the technology could be tested in a few years in a commercial or government fleet to start. You know what? I say let's start it in a government fleet after we just saw recently Secret Service agents having some sort of accident outside the White House, running over cones after leaving a party while drunk. It sounds like a good idea to me. All right, so I don't know. This shit's all keeping us safe. I'm sure that they will find some way using wireless to send all of your readings to your insurance company, probably your doctor, and to the database that tracks all your healthcare records. It's just insane. I don't want to be surveilled. You know, next they're going to be surveilling you taking a shit, and this just isn't right in any way, shape, or form. But wait, it gets even better than that. Another one out of phys.org this morning. Injectable electronics. Yes, I said it. Injectable electronics hold promise for basic neuroscience and treatment of neurodegenerative diseases. Now, we talked about all kinds of different neurodegenerative diseases yesterday. Alzheimer's, dementia, mad cow disease, chronic wasting disease. We did not mention CJD and CVJD. Krupchev-Jacobs disease, which is the human form of mad cow disease. But hey, don't worry about that, because it appears they're working on a treatment for all that crap. It's a notion that might be pulled from the pages of a science fiction novel. Yeah, you think. Electronic devices that can be injected directly into the brain or other body parts and treat everything from neurodegenerative disorders to paralysis. Thank God. Transhumanism is here. It does sound unlikely unless you visit Charles Lieber's lab. A team of international researchers led by Lieber, the Mark Hyman Jr. Professor of Chemistry, an international team of researchers developed a method for fabricating nanoscale electronic scaffolds that can be injected via a syringe. Once connected to electronic devices, the scaffolds can be used to monitor neural activity, stimulate tissues, and even promote regenerations of neurons. The study is described in a June 8th paper in Nature Nanotechnology. How frightening is that? Yes, let's put these little electronic devices into our brains and have them regenerate neurons. I mean, why don't you just eat some turmeric and see if that helps first, right? Quote, I do feel that this has a potential to be revolutionary, says Lieber. This opens up a completely new frontier where we can explore the interface between electronic structures and, yes, biology. Again, people, this just isn't right. I don't know. Think what you will. I have friends that'll argue with me to the death about how great this is. And if it was my child who was dying, wouldn't I line them up to get one of these therapies? The problem is human 1.0 is going to be gone here in another generation as we allow this melding of technology with biology. And do we think that that's the right thing to do? I don't know. Human 1.0, I was pretty happy with. I like being analog. I really never wanted to be digital ever. You know, even after seeing, what was that movie in the 80s? Tron. Tron was cool, but I really didn't want to be on one of those little motorcycles ruled by the machine. Thank you very much. Back to the story. For the past 30 years, people have made incremental improvements into the microfabrication techniques that have now allowed us to make rigid probes smaller and smaller. But no one has addressed this issue, the electronics cellular interface at the level to which biology works. The idea of merging the biological with the electronic is not a new one for Lieber. In an earlier study, Lieber's lab demonstrated that scaffolds could be used to create, oh yes, what, we're hearing this again, cyborg tissue. When cardiac or nerve cells were grown with embedded scaffolds, researchers were then able to use the devices to record electrical signals generated by the tissues and to measure changes in those signals as they administered cardio or neurostimulating drugs. Quote, we were able to demonstrate that we could make the scaffold and culture cells within it, but we didn't really have an idea as how to insert that into pre-existing tissue. But if you want to study the brain, and yes, the Big Brain Project, look it up if you haven't looked into it. It's a global thing, and they are looking at ways to completely stimulate and create a human brain and crack all of the mysteries. So back to this. But if you want to study the brain or develop tools to explore the brain-machine interface, you need to stick something into the body, he says. And when releasing the electronic scaffold completely from the fabrication substrate, we noticed that it was almost invisible and very flexible like a polymer, and that it could literally be sucked into a glass needle or a pipette. From there, we simply asked, well, would it be possible to deliver the mesh electronics by syringe needle injection, a common process to the delivery of many species in biology and medicine? And if you could, you could go to the doctor and you could inject this and you would be wired up, unquote. Oh, I need to breathe. Though not the first attempts at implanting electronics into the brain, deep brain stimulation has been used to treat a variety of disorders for decades. Yeah, where they literally like cut open your skull and then put these diodes in there. But remember, too, DARPA's been working with that in regards to PTSD patients and removing and adding memories as well recently. The nano-fabricated scaffolds operate on a completely different scale. Quote, existing techniques are crude relative to the way the brain is wired, Lieber explains, and whether it is a silicone probe or flexible polymers, they cause inflammation in the tissue that requires periodically changing the position or the stimulation. But with our injectable electronics, it's as if they were not there at all. They are 1 million times more flexible than any state-of-the-art electronics and have subcellular feature sizes. They're what I call neurophilic. That's neuro-philic. And they actually like to interact with neurons. Despite their enormous potential, the fabrication of injectable scaffolds is surprisingly easy. Well, geez, that's great. That's the beauty of all this, says Lieber. It is compatible with conventional manufacturing techniques as well. The process is similar to that used to etch microchips and begins with a dissolvable layer deposited on a substrate. To create the scaffold, researchers lay out a mesh of nanowires, which we've already just read recently about them not only putting nanowires into human brains, but also putting nanowires into the pupae of moths. We read that a few days ago. And as the pupae grows and then comes out of its cocoon, those nanowires grow right inside the muscular tissue of the insects. So when it's a full-grown moth, they can literally use a joystick to manipulate this moth's muscles and make it into a live living cyborg. I mean, how frightening. So now, hey, guess what? We can inject humans too, and it works just very much the same. It says to create the scaffold, researchers lay out a mesh of nanowires sandwiched in layers of organic polymer. The first layer is then dissolved, leaving a flexible mesh, which can be drawn into a syringe needle and administered like any other injection. You know, who's to say that they're not going to be putting this stuff into vaccinations without our knowledge, even? Since you don't have any type of inflammation or reaction from this, it sounds like they found a way to slip this past the blood-brain barrier, does it not? Especially if it's nano-sized. After injection, the input-output of the mesh can be connected to standard measuring electronics so that the integrated devices can be addressed and used to stimulate or record neural activity. These types of things have never been done before from both a fundamental neuroscience and a medical perspective, said Lieber. It is very exciting, he says, rubbing his hands together, I'm sure. And there are a lot of potential applications going forward. I bet you this dude and Kurzweil probably toss Bruce back together. Going forward, Lieber says, researchers hope to better understand how the brain and other tissues react to injectable electronics over longer periods. Oh, and wouldn't you know, Harvard is involved here. Harvard's Office of Technology Development has filed for a provisional patent on the technology and is actively seeking commercialization opportunities. Quote, having those results can prove that this is really a viable technology, said Lieber. The idea of being able to precisely position and record from very specific areas or even from specific neurons over an extended period of time, this could, I think, make a huge impact on neuroscience. Yes, the brain police are coming for you. Don't worry, it'll be here soon enough. Like, how frightening is that? I mean, of course they're going to put it under the guise of being able to help people with brain damage or help people who, you know, have lost the use of their limbs. That's the way they always sell this crap. But don't think that it's going to be for your benefit. You are just the guinea pig, and they are selling you the benefit to get you to be the first in line. But it absolutely is not the end result. Oh, I have so much more. I mean, where do we go from here? Do we look at more transhumanism or do we get to more disease stuff? I don't know. Let's do one more on transhumanism. The new bionic contact lens. Yes, it's coming. Could make glasses obsolete. Personally, I like my glasses. I've had them since I was 9. They are a permanent fixture on my nose. When I take them off, I don't recognize myself. So I will not be lining up for this. It says this could be the end of glasses. Your eyesight may be about to get a big, huge boost if the new bionic contact lens makes it to market. Invented by an optometrist in Canada. Go Canada! The Ocumetics bionic lens promises to enhance eyesight to a level that is 3 times better than 20/20, the universal standard for normal vision. Oh my God. And I saw just recently, I don't remember, I think it was infrared, that they had a contact lens that was, I don't know if it was actually on the market, but they were definitely testing it to give you infrared vision, which, you know, hey, would be kind of cool to be able to have night vision. But on the other hand, you know, if you were trying to get away from somebody in the woods running. You definitely would not want them to have infrared vision at the blink of an eye. All right, back to the story. These aren't lenses that you pop in and out, though. The lenses developed by Gareth Webb is inserted into the eye via a painless procedure that takes, yes, less than 10 minutes. Webb says that the process is a lot like cataract surgery. I don't know about you, but even people who had that LASIK surgery laying down under a laser shot into their eyeball, that's something I'm not going to ever go for. I hate to tell you, I don't like anything in my eye, let alone someone zapping me with a laser. These lenses don't degrade over time, so you will never have a problem with cataracts or failing vision, no matter how long you live. Yeah, so it sounds like it's perfect for the transhumanist crowd, the ones who are planning on living forever with augmentation. Let's just put in the bionic lens. So even if your eyesight gets bad, it can adjust for that. The Ocumetics bionic lens incorporates a patented miniature optic system that works like a tiny digital camera. Oh, so I bet you the next version will be able to take pictures as well and save them into the flash storage they've inserted into your brain. It works like a tiny digital camera powered by the body, and it can shift focus from close-range objects to objects any distance away faster than the human eye is able to. Such technology isn't invented in a day, of course. The lens has been 8 years in the making, and it's cost about $3 million to develop so far. This vision enhancement that the world has never seen before, this is a vision enhancement the world has never seen before, Webb told CBS News. If you can just barely see the clock at 10 feet away, when you get a bionic lens, you can see the clock from 30 meters away. Actually, let's see if there was an interview here or not. It doesn't look like it. It's just a link to the original article. All right, back to where I was. Ocumetics Technology Corp., which owns the technology, says it is safe and durable, and the implanted lens feels natural and will not cause headaches or any kind of eye strain. Nevertheless, there is a way to go before it hits the market. A launch has been tentatively set for 2017 after extensive clinical trials have been completed. For Webb, it is an innovation that is close to his own heart. At age 45, I had to struggle with reading glasses, which, like most people, I found was a great insult. Well, yes, I had to get bifocals right at 40 as well, but I did not find it to be a great insult personally. I found it to be just something that happens when you hit that age. To this day, I curse my progressive glasses. I also wear contact lenses, which I also curse just about every day. My heroes were cowboys, he says, and cowboys just did not wear glasses. Wow. So is that his motivation, cowboys, to start turning us into cyborgs? I guess so. If the Ocumetics bionic lens makes it to the market, then a whole host of eyesight problems could be overcome, not least having to wear glasses or contact lenses. Clinical trials are now being set to begin on animals and blind human beings. I'm thinking that they mean clinically blind, not fully blind, where there is no proper connection between the optic nerve and the brain. People who are rated as clinically blind can still see. It's just very, very fuzzy. And of course, it will be targeted to the people who need it most, they say. In addition to his main work on the bionic lenses, Webb has set up a charitable foundation called Celebration of Sight, dedicated to helping organizations provide eye surgery for developing countries. And yes, that's where we always start, isn't it? Funds have also been earmarked for eye research institutes across the world. Now, I'm not saying that any of these groups or inventors are evil people, okay? They think that they are doing the right thing. They're using technology to help people who they say really need it. But on the other hand, how far do we push the envelope before we are not considered human 1.0 anymore? And how far do we then, who don't line up for these technologies, how long before they deem us to be inferior humans and either force the upgrade or exterminate the inferior? I mean, look at what happens in the computer world. I'm thinking in particular like Windows XP. That is the most recent operating system to be discontinued, and all support for it, any upgrades, any patches by Microsoft have been discontinued. If we don't go ahead with these future upgrades once it's become commonplace, look at what's happening in the vaccination movement. Doctors are already telling their patients that if you don't get vaccinated, I'm not going to treat you anymore. My dentist, we talked about this, pulled the same crap on me. If I don't stick my kid into one of those panoramic x-rays, which with all of the studies that I've read, increases brain cancer and are absolutely unnecessary unless you have a major orthodontic problem, my dentist is not going to treat my kid anymore because I'm not going to stick my kid in that machine. Because I have real issues. There hasn't been a lot of research done as to how radiation over an extended lifetime, that, by the way, nobody is tracking, and all radiation is cumulative, how that's going to affect my child. But there is evidence that these panoramic x-rays cause brain cancer. I mean, we are seeing this forced medical establishment coming down our throats faster than you can blink an eye. And it's only going to get worse as people who just don't get the big picture are opening their arms saying, I want to be part of the machine. All right. Where do we go from here? I think we're going to jump back. I was talking about bird flu a couple days ago, and I had not seen any updates. We were following this. The last we had seen was 14 million chickens and turkeys had been culled as this mysterious, never before seen in the United States, worst outbreak in history, was killing chickens and turkeys and causing them to be culled. Now, remember, we did look at how they've been engineering many of these bird flus in the lab, the CDC being one. The 1918 flu is another one that they've engineered to make them more virulent. Well, now, a story that came out of Reuters that I found yesterday as an update from Monday, June 8th. We are now up to 46 million. So we went from 14 to 46 million. Chickens and turkeys have been culled and have died in a bird flu outbreak that is opening. Now check this out. It's opening a rare fissure within the usually tight-knit U.S. poultry industry. This is titled Bird Flu Vaccine, Go Figure. Under development divides U.S. poultry industry. So not only do we have the vacker, anti-vacker argument because of Johnny ruining a whole bunch of Disney World trips, getting the measles. And then we had the doggy flu, remember? That doggy flu, which happened to be birdie flu, and somehow got into dogs. And they were encouraging all of the dog owners across America with their oxytocin love hormone. So they treat their dogs like children to go running off to the veterinarian and getting your dogs vaccinated, even though the current doggy flu vaccine doesn't cover this birdie flu. But make sure you do it to keep your doggy safe. They now are taking the vacker, anti-vacker argument to the poultry industry. Yes, they are. The death of more than 46 million chickens and turkeys in a bird flu outbreak is opening a rare fissure within the usually tight-knit U.S. poultry industry, pitting farmers with infected flocks against those who so far largely have sidestepped the worst outbreak in U.S. history. Yes, never before seen, worst ever. At issue, whether to vaccinate poultry against the highly pathogenic bird flu virus. Hard-hit turkey producers in the Midwest say they will continue to urge the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the good old USDA, who isn't keeping us safe, as we found out listening to the video about the cancerous cows. They are urging the USDA to approve a vaccine to protect their flocks even after the agency decided on Wednesday, believe it or not, against releasing a vaccine it was developing because the tests showed that it was not effective enough. That really surprised me, but hey, chalk one up for them. Chicken farmers in states not yet hit by the bird flu, such as Mississippi, are lobbying against the approval of a vaccination program without more testing and economic analysis. Well, I'm going to give a round of applause for the Mississippi farmers because at least they have a modicum of sense. They don't want it released without more testing because they don't know what it's going to do to their chickens. Many producers worry vaccinated birds could actually spread the virus. What? Yes. Have we not been discussing that in regards to even human vaccinations? Many producers worry the vaccinated birds could actually spread the virus, while exporters say a vaccination program could act as a trigger for rejection of U.S. poultry in foreign markets. Well, check that out. James Sumner, president of the USA Poultry and Egg Export Council, highlighted the economic risks of vaccinating birds, but said the organization did not have an official position on whether the USDA should approve a vaccination program. Quote, certain segments of the industry certainly do want to vaccinate, but it comes with complications, he says. I don't think there are too many countries that have vaccinated and found it to be successful for their industry. But why? Why, you ask? The stakes in the U.S. decision on whether to approve a vaccine are particularly high for farmers who raise broiler chickens for meat. U.S. producers export about $5.7 billion worth of poultry and eggs each year, about three quarters of which comes from the broiler industry. The USA Poultry and Egg Export Council estimates about $600 million in trade losses in the first quarter of this year alone due to the restrictions imposed by importing countries because of the bird flu infections. But so far, most countries have imposed restrictions due to the outbreak, and they have restricted shipments from geographic areas with infections. However, exporters worry that more buyers will impose nationwide bans on imports from the U.S. if a vaccine is used, and the exact impact is unknown because the United States has never before used a vaccine to fight the highly pathogenic bird flu. Again, never, ever, ever before. The dispute over vaccination is unusual for the poultry industry, where chicken and turkey growers usually present a united front on issues involving regulation and trade. Well, isn't this interesting that the vaccine debate is again causing a huge divide? But let's find out why. The National Chicken Council, a trade group representing the broiler industry, asked the USDA in a letter last month to determine how the top 20 export markets for the U.S. poultry would react to vaccines before approving an immunization plan. The group also asks, so it's all about dollar and cents for them, apparently. The group also said that it was uncertain that a vaccine would reduce the number of infected flocks. Some poultry makers are concerned, and here we go, that inoculated birds might, quote unquote, shed the live virus, putting other birds at risk of catching the fatal disease. And we have found that in humans as well, though they will argue tooth and nail that vaccinated children do not shed live virus when they're injected with live virus. It absolutely has been proven to be true. The one I remember at 100% where the FDA was warning against that was the intranasal, I don't even know if you call it a vaccine, but it was an intranasal version of the vaccine for swine flu that they were giving to children. And it was a live virus. And the children would be shedding that live virus for 7 to 10 days beyond getting that intranasal. So apparently there is concern for this bird flu vaccine as well. It says, quote, we are opposed to using it without it fully being tested. Gee, you think? Says Mike Cockerell, chief financial officer of Sanderson Farm, Inc., the third largest U.S. poultry producer. For the vaccination program to be effective, it would need to be part of a broader strategy, including improving disinfection methods on farms and swiftly killing infected flocks. Yes, like Minnesota did by calling in the National Guard with water and foam to suffocate them. Otherwise, it'll be difficult to distinguish between flocks infected with the virus and those that are vaccinated. We know we just can't vaccinate the birds and live with the virus, he said. We need to get rid of this virus. Yeah, why are we doing that with a lot of different viruses, like that Paswan and all these new tick-borne viruses that are at epidemic proportions in the woods of the Northeast? The USDA has said that it would use a vaccine as a last resort, and yes, they'll probably fast-track that shit like they do on humans when they declare an emergency, though many of these states, you know, have actually already declared emergencies. It says the USDA has said it views the use of vaccines as a last resort, preferring attempts to eliminate the virus by quarantining infected farms and culling the birds there. The large death toll of birds in the current outbreak is partly because of culling. You know, another thing, though, is this whole quarantine issue. We saw that with the quote unquote Ebola outbreak. We also saw an executive order go through at that time about upper respiratory diseases that could be easily transmissible between humans and quarantining humans. We came upon a lot of human rights issues and whether or not you deserve to be quarantined. I'm telling you, people, with all of these quote-unquote never-before-seen outbreaks, failures in security to keep us safe, anthrax being shipped all around the globe, and whoops, the DOD doesn't know how it happened, and their entire procedure appears to be faulty. This is concerning to me. All of this is painting a very ugly future picture. How long is it going to be before they decide to insert one of these little electronic devices under our skin? And we just read about one the other day that can take blood glucose levels, and they didn't give any other specifics, but they said other things that they'll be able to detect under the skin in your blood to determine whether or not you need to be quarantined or whether or not you are worthy. The very last story we looked at yesterday was in regards to how negative lifestyle decisions and choices in like the food you eat or the situation that you're in, whether or not you're poor and you've led a hard life, whether or not that damages your DNA for future generations. How long is it going to be before they're judging who is worthy to procreate and who isn't? Who is worthy to live and who isn't? Who's costing the state too much money to be worth extending your life? And as natural resources, whether be artificially reduced or if it's naturally being reduced, how worthy you are to consume the few last natural resources that are left here on the planet. Here's one last story I'm going to try to hit, and this is continuing on the birds. We had predicted this, and we know now it's happening. Heb grocery stores, which I know my friends in Texas all know who Heb is, up here in the upstate New York region in the Northeast. We have like a Wegmans that I think would probably be pretty similar to Heb. It's a pretty large grocery store chain. Heb has officially begun rationing eggs. There's a video here. So let's see if we can play this one. If not, I'll read it. And maybe not. I'll read while it's deciding whether or not it's going to play. It says, in recent days, an ominous sign has appeared throughout Texas. Quote, eggs are not for commercial sale, reads the warning. Well, this isn't going to play, so let me just disconnect this so I don't have the hiss. Eggs are not for commercial sale, reads the warning printed on a traditional 8.5 by 11 piece of paper and posted at Heb grocery stores across Texas. The purchase of eggs is limited to 3 cartons of eggs per customer. Now, I don't know about you, but I never buy 3 cartons at a time. But still, the fact that they even have to say that should be concerning to you. The price of everything, supply and demand, right? As they deem something to be a limited resource, the price goes up. And as employment and wages go down, as the United States is getting ready to become a third world nation with all of these super secret trade deals that they're negotiating that are classified, don't think that there's going to be food for you or me eventually. It's all going to be bug protein. Hebb, which operates 350 supermarkets, is one of the largest chains, not only in the state, but in the whole country. And it has begun, as the casual but foreboding notices warn, to ration its eggs. Quote, the United States is facing what they say is a temporary disruption in the supply of eggs due to the avian flu, says a statement released on Thursday last week. Hebb is committing to ensuring Texas families and households have access to eggs. The sign placed on our shelves last week is to deter commercial users from buying eggs in bulk. You know, how long is it going to be now before they come up with a synthetic version of eggs if they haven't already? And they're going to make that what we eat. Not natural eggs. Get yourself some backyard chickens, I say, and keep them safe from bird flu. It says the news, as the grocer suggests, comes on the heels of what has been a devastating several months for egg farmers in the United States. Avian flu, which has proven lethal in other parts of the world, has spread throughout the United States like wildfire. Yes, they said it. Since April, when it began spreading by the thousands per week, it has escalated to the point of a national crisis. And yes, people, just wait, because it's going to get bigger. As of this month, 46 million chickens and turkeys have been killed, according to the USDA, and nearly 80% of those were egg-laying hens. All right, guys. And if you eat eggs, you're going to pay the price as well. So that about wraps it up for today. We're down to the last 30 seconds. It is Tuesday, which means we have lots and lots and lots and lots of live radio. Mr. Kevin Blanch is up next. Libby Haleve's show from this week follows that. And then make sure you stick around. Mr. Chuck Ocelli live at 6. Against the Wall with JJ at 8. Primer Time with Nick and Michael at 9. Geoengineering Watch with Dane Wigington at 10. And Anti-Media with SM Gibson at 11. Everybody is live today. You guys have an awesome Tuesday, and we will catch up with you tomorrow.